for this knowledge.
Peter Linebaugh, we want to thank you very much for joining us. People's historian, retired from the University of Toledo, author of the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. He joins us from Lincoln Castle in Lincolnshire, England, where in a locked stone vault are kept the finest originals of the Magna Carta and the charters of English liberty. He's speaking there tonight about the relevance of the Magna Carta to the Black Lives Matter movement. We'll link to details on our website, as well as our previous interview with Professor Linebaugh on Guantanamo and habeas corpus. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and an engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org, both full-time jobs based here in New York City. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Osbeck, Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Food Wars 8, hosted by Clinton Street Theater. This annual music and comedy festival is also a food drive and will feature entertainment from August in Blue, Bad Habit, Tragedy, Boomer, Belinda Carroll, and more. Again, that's Food Wars 8, Sunday, June 21st at 5 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Shell's Arctic drilling rig left Seattle today amid protests.
Drought has been declared in more than half of Oregon's counties.
An activist held a 24-hour vigil on the steps of the U.S. Capitol to protest fast-tracking an agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 15th, 2015. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Ken Jones. On Friday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown declared four more counties in the state of Oregon to be under an official drought emergency. This makes more than half of all Oregon counties officially in a drought. The declaration allows the state to begin prioritizing water usage between agricultural and residential users. The governor has asked the state legislature to approve up to $56 million to fund a statewide water management program. 19 counties are now classified as being in severe drought. This is more than double the amount of counties affected by drought last year, which was a record year in itself. The governor warned that because of the drought, Oregon faces an unprecedented wildfire risk this summer.
The Oregon legislature on Friday passed a bill that would require companies to provide paid sick leave to all employees. The bill, passed along largely party lines, now goes to Governor Kate Brown's desk. She is expected to sign it. The bill requires all businesses with at least 10 employees to offer paid sick leave for either an individual's illness or their child's illness. Businesses with less than 10 employees will be required to offer unpaid sick leave. Senate Bill 454 will require employees to offer at least 40 hours of paid sick leave per year to employees. The bill makes Oregon one of four states in the county in the country to require paid sick leave to employees. The other states are California, Connecticut, and Massachusetts.
In Seattle today, more than 20 people, including a city council member, were arrested in a kayak blockade of an Arctic oil drilling rig. After the Coast Guard removed the protesters and handed them over to local police, the Shell Oil Company's drilling rig continued on its way to the Arctic to begin drilling. The activists pointed out that it'd be impossible to clean up an oil spill in the rough waters of the Arctic Ocean. An environmental impact statement on the Shell oil drilling program found drilling in the Arctic would have a more than 75% chance of resulting in a major oil spill. This summer will be the first time Shell has returned to the Arctic since 2012, when its exploratory drilling program was plagued by mechanical failures, and its drilling vessel Kulik ran aground on an island near Kodiak, Alaska. Last month, the National Transportation Safety Board found that Shell's inadequate assessment of risk was responsible for the Kulik incident, according to the Associated Press. In the midst of this morning's action, the mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, issued a tweet from his official account saying, quote, "In a sane world, the U.S. Coast Guard and Seattle Police Department would be corralling Shell's Arctic drilling rig, not clearing its path," unquote. McGinn has also asked who our elected leaders work for, referring to the federally run U.S. Coast Guard. He said the self-proclaimed kayaktivists pose no threat to public safety, but Shell does. The Shell drilling rig, known as the Polar Pioneer, is headed to the Chukchi Sea off the northwest coast of Alaska to begin exploratory oil and natural gas drilling this summer while the sea is free of ice. After leaving the port of Seattle this morning, it appeared to have run aground for several hours near Bainbridge Island when more kayakers paddled out to try to stop it, but the rig then continued on its way north. Kayak protests are planned along the Washington coast in the following days. Greenpeace USA's Arctic campaign organizer Curtis Dangler spoke with FSRN's Shannon Young.
Can you start by giving a brief rundown of what happened in Puget Sound this morning?
This morning, we had an action out on the water. This action has basically been coming for a long time, ever since the Port of Seattle announced that it had secretly signed a lease to host Shell Oil's Arctic drilling fleet here, to sort of use Seattle as a pit stop, you could say, for destroying the planet. And ever since then, a movement has been building on the ground, and people have been saying since day one that they'll do everything in their power to stop Shell from drilling in the Arctic. And today, all these actions have culminated, and what we saw was everybody out on the water putting themselves between Shell and the Arctic. And that was a beautiful sight. A lot of people were up at the crack of dawn, paddled out there in the dark, I have to say. People had lanterns, LED lights, and nobody knew exactly how things would go, but this is sort of the climax, you could say, of the local battle. But I could say we have a lot of mixed emotions here. In some ways, it's really chilling to see that rig leave and know what that represents. But at the same time, it's a really inspiring moment to see everybody willing to put themselves on the line and stand, like I said, between Shell and the Arctic.
About how many people were out on the water today?
You know, that is a great question. When you're out in the thick of it, sometimes that's the last thing you're thinking about. I would estimate about 100 boats. Something like that. Around 100 boats. There were a lot of kayaks in the water. There was at least one canoe family, a Native American canoe family from the Lummi tribe here in Washington State. And as I heard, there was a sailboat with a Shell no flag. Pretty diverse picture out there.
What was the reaction from the authorities?
The reaction from the authorities from the get-go was pretty intense, to say the least. It was probably pretty obvious from the moment that the action started that they were going to do everything in their power to get us out of the way as soon as possible. And that began with warnings. The Coast Guard came up to a lot of kayakers who were deploying a banner, telling them that there's a safety zone that's being violated. But people's reaction was to remain peaceful and calm and to say we're exercising our free speech, we're aware of the safety zone, we're protesting Shell drilling in the Arctic. And really, basically went about our way. But eventually, the Coast Guard, after giving enough warnings, started one by one coming up to the kayaks and pulling people out of the water, placing people under arrest. And a lot of us were taken to the Coast Guard station after that. It took a long time for them to get everybody out of the water and out of the way. And I could say with confidence that Shell's mooring was significantly delayed, but everybody made it to the Coast Guard station in one piece and was released after being processed basically with the equivalent of a traffic violation. We were all issued $250 citations for violating a safety zone.
Are there any groups in communities along the way to the Chukchi Sea planning actions like what happened in Seattle?
I know that communities in British Columbia, for example, have already demonstrated against Shell in kayaks and on the shore because some of Shell's support vessels for their Arctic fleet have already headed north through British Columbia. It's my understanding that, folks are going to take action as well. I don't know exactly what the plans are, but Arctic drilling is not a popular project. We all have a stake in it. What happens in the Arctic affects us all. And we're going to see continued protests until Obama denies Shell the permits and stops Arctic drilling. Shell's not going to stop themselves, and communities are starting to really take matters into their own hands. So whether it's in British Columbia or in Alaska, you can expect to see resistance everywhere.
Curtis Dengler, anything else you'd like to add?
One thing I'd like to say is that on a personal level, I have family in Alaska, and I was actually in Dutch Harbor on Alaska when the Noble Discoverer ran aground in 2012 during Shell's last attempt to drill oil in the Arctic. And so I know firsthand how reckless Shell could be. They drug anchor to shore, basically, in a protected bay, and they expect to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean with some of the most dangerous and unpredictable weather. It's a reckless project from a conservation perspective. We have an endangered species there. The risk of a spill is basically inevitable. The federal government says there's a 75% chance of a major oil spill. We know for a fact that it's possible to clean up such a spill. For example, if there's a blowout, say in September or October, oil could gush uncontrollably for 7-8 months because it's going to ice over all winter, and you can't clean it up under the ice. And that would devastate all kinds of not only animal communities, but human communities. But the biggest issue, I think, that's uniting people against Shell and against Arctic drilling is the climate issue. We simply cannot afford, as a planet, to burn Arctic oil if we expect to avoid catastrophic climate change. We literally have to choose between Arctic drilling and a livable planet. We can't have both. So the actions that are being taken everywhere signify that people are choosing a living planet, and they know that we can't just expect Shell to stop themselves. And so far, elected officials from the Port of Seattle to the Obama administration have failed us. And so we need to make a stink. We need to put ourselves between Shell and the Arctic. We need to do everything we can where we are to stop them, because we're literally fighting for our futures out here. We're fighting for our lives.
Curtis Dengler is an Arctic campaign organizer with Greenpeace USA and a kayaktivist. He joined us by phone from Seattle, Washington. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The state of Washington has officially closed recreational and commercial Dungeness crab fishing after tests revealed unsafe toxin levels in the crabs. The naturally occurring toxin reached harmful levels, prompting Washington State to close the season. Razor clam fisheries in Oregon and Washington also closed their season earlier this year due to high toxin levels. Recent tests show the Dungeness crabs have toxin levels more than twice the legal limit. Washington fishery managers have closed Dungeness crab season in the past, but never on this scale. Dan Ayers of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife said the state has never had a major closure of the crab season for ocean fishing. The closure applies only to the state of Oregon, or Washington. As of today, all Oregon Dungeness crab fisheries remain open.
TriMet's new light rail orange line, connecting downtown Portland with Milwaukee, is currently under construction and scheduled to open this September. As part of the project, archaeologists and contractors are collecting historical artifacts along the new line. TriMet is presenting a public talk this Wednesday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at the Bridgeport Brew Pub in Portland's Pearl District. The talk will be called Where the Past Meets the Future. TriMet officials will present pictures and descriptions of the artifacts and what they tell us about Portland's history over the past 150 or so years. For more information, I spoke with Joe Recker, TriMet's Coordinator of Environmental Permits. Joe, the Portland-Milwaukee Light Rail Transit Project, better known as the Max Orange Line, is currently under construction, set to open in September. Can you tell us a little bit about the new line?
Sure, I can tell you a little bit. It's a 7.3-mile light rail extension. It goes from PSU in downtown Portland through South Waterfront into inner southeast Portland and then down through Milwaukee and North Clackamas County. It's on time, under budget, and things are going really well.
And you're giving a presentation this Wednesday, actually, June 17th at 6 p.m. at Bridgeport Pub downtown on a very interesting topic connected to the project. What's the subject of the talk?
Well, the title of the presentation is Where the Past Meets the Future, and it's about all of the history and archaeological finds that were discovered during the 3 or so years of construction of the Orange Line.
Now, is that archaeological project part of your job role at TriMet as the Environmental Permits Coordinator?
It is. It's one of the more exciting parts of my job. Part of my job is ensuring environmental compliance with all the state, federal, and local laws. And one of those is Section 106, which is a federal provision. And it basically has to do with ensuring that we don't negatively impact cultural resources. In this case, it's archaeological resources. And those are largely unknown at the time you begin construction. So we have a team of contract archaeologists that are out during construction doing monitoring. And my job is to manage their work to ensure that we're doing what we said we would do in terms of complying with that law.
Before starting the construction, then, is there some initial research that's done, especially by this team of consulting archaeologists?
Absolutely. During the planning phase, that comes into place. So what we start off with is usually historical documents. The most commonly used are Sanborn maps, and those were developed by an insurance company, Sanborn, to identify and describe every building in a city. And just about every city in the U.S., I believe, has these maps. And they're longitudinal over time. So you can have a map in 1880, 1890, 1900, 1900-something. And they really provide a good glimpse at what might be in the location that we're doing construction. In addition, we do pedestrian field surveys where the archaeologists go and walk around and look for archaeological features or hints of them. And they do occasionally do some dig tests before the project starts. And that helps create a plan that that really sets the stage for the construction activity. And part of that plan is that we have a training session. And on this project, because it's fairly large and we have multiple teams working on it, we had training sessions that helped the contractor be able to identify hints of archaeological sites, even if there's not an archaeological monitor present.
So somebody who's doing the actual digging and construction, they could stop if they see something that is of interest and they've been trained to look for.
Exactly. And for this project, the contractor actually came forward on many occasions and said, hey, we found something that looks like it could be an archaeological feature. It's a series of bricks, and it looks like either a foundation or a cistern or something like that. Other things they're trained to look for are charred rocks, which may be emblematic of some sort of campsite or settlement from prehistoric times. So they're looking for all of that stuff when they're out there in the field.
The question of most interest to me and probably all the listeners is, what have you found so far? And if there's a lot of things that you found, a lot of artifacts, what seems to be the most interesting find?
We found a full range of different types of archaeological sites and buried historic features. And they range quite a bit. Downtown Portland and even in Milwaukee, we found what are brick-lined shaft features, and archaeologists love these things. These are what were previously used as privies in many cases, and when sewer systems came online in the 1880s, 1890s, they started to get filled up with historic trash, and they're just chock full of artifacts that when you look at them in a stratified sample, gives a good tale about who was living where and what their socioeconomic lifestyle and status were. And we can correlate that to census records from that time period.
Oh, kind of based on what they threw away or threw down the toilet into the sewer system?
Right. And it was really just a hole in the ground at that point, but they filled up over time. Some of our some of the artifacts that were found date back to the 1870s and 80s. So we found features like that, and those were really exciting.
We had mentioned that you're giving the presentation on the archaeological findings this Wednesday evening at Bridgeport Brewpub. I looked at the website, and it seems like RSVPs are already at their limit. Does that mean that people who are listening now who haven't already RSVP'd will not be able to get in?
Not necessarily. We're not really sure how many people who RSVP via Facebook or other social media actually will show up. At this point, we don't want to guarantee that anyone else who hasn't RSVP'd will get in. We're not actually going to be checking to see if you're on a list, but it's really going to be, for the most part, first come, first serve, as it would at any of our Transit on Tap functions. So if someone's really excited about coming, they're certainly welcome to come, and I would encourage them to come fairly early, maybe as early as 5 or 5:30. A good thing, though, is that we're going to be videotaping that presentation, and it's going to be made available to everyone to watch at their own leisure on our website.
And what's the website?
It's catchtheorange.com.
We've been talking with Joe Recker, TriMet's Coordinator of Environmental Permits. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Sarah Sweatsoff interview with one of the organizers of the peace rallies for Yemen this past weekend, followed by Labor Radio on at 6. At 6:30, Adam Carpinelli interviews members of Cop Watch, Don't Shoot Portland, and Right to Survive about police sweeps, the displacement of homeless communities in Portland on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy, with a high of 80 and a low of 51. Today in history, in 1846, the Oregon Treaty established the 49th parallel as the border between the United States and Canada. In 1934, the Great Smokies National Park is founded. Quote of the day today is from Edward O. Wilson. Perhaps the time has come to cease calling it the environmentalist view, as though it were a lobbying effort outside of the mainstream of human activity, and to start calling it the real world view.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When a big name retailer finds its sales in a slow downward spiral, the geniuses in the executive suite often try to keep their profits up by cheapening their product and delivering less to customers. To see how well this strategy works, look no further than the declining sales at Walmart and McDonald's. When the geniuses in charge of these behemoths applied the cutback strategy, their slow decline turned into a perilous nosedive. You'd think their experience would keep other executives from making the same mistake, but here comes an even bigger and much more important retail behemoth saying, "We have to cut to survive." That's the pronouncement last year by the honcho of the U.S. Postal Service, which has been eliminating employees, closing facilities, and reducing services for years. Each new round of reductions drives away more customers, which causes clueless executives to prescribe more cuts. In a January decree, USPS virtually eliminated overnight delivery of first-class mail, and is now planning to close or consolidate 82 regional mail processing plants. This means fewer workers handling the nation's growing load of mail, creating further delays in delivery. The answer to this, say the Slap Happy executives, is, guess what? To cut even more service out of Postal Service. They want to close hundreds of our local post offices and eliminate Saturday mail delivery, which is one of USPS's major competitive advantages. This is Jim Hightower saying, fed up with the deliberate degradation of this vital public service, postal workers themselves are putting forth a vision and an innovative plan not merely for USPS to survive, but to thrive. With more than 70 other national groups, they've forged a grand alliance to save our public postal service. To be part of its actions, go to agrandalliance.org, agrandalliance.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Just a correction to the schedule. At 7 tonight, we'll have the River Signal instead of Hard Knock Radio. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal by the state of North Carolina on one of the nation's most stringent anti-abortion bill. The bill, passed over the veto threat of the Democratic governor, would have required doctors to show pregnant women an ultrasound of their fetus before performing an abortion. The law was ruled unconstitutional by the United States Appeals Court earlier because it illegally limited a doctor's right to free speech. By refusing to hear the case, the Supreme Court has essentially upheld that ruling. Although the North Carolina anti-abortion bill was rejected by the Supreme Court, similar laws in Texas and North Dakota have been upheld by federal courts.
The Oregon Center for Public Policy has released a study showing that undocumented Oregonians contribute taxes to local and state budgets in a number of ways. The study also showed that if these Oregonians were given a path to citizenship, tax revenue for local and state government could increase by 47%. This means that undocumented immigrants would be paying more taxes than the wealthiest 1%. KBOO's Eric Tegedoff spoke with Tyler McCannis, policy analyst for the Oregon Center for Public Policy and author of the study.
I'm speaking today with Tyler McCannis from the Oregon Center of Public Policy, and you were making this interesting argument that immigration could help boost Oregon budgets across the board, state and local. How do undocumented Oregonians currently pay into the system?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we put out a fact sheet today that shows that undocumented Oregonians are currently taxpayers and that their tax contributions would increase with federal immigration reforms. So undocumented folks here in Oregon pay taxes currently in a number of ways. Many of them pay through payroll taxes taken out of their paychecks. Folks who are homeowners pay property taxes, and even folks who are renting apartments pay property taxes indirectly through their landlords. And folks pay taxes like excise taxes when they fill up their tanks at the gas pump.
What changes would there be to that tax base if these Oregonians were given a path to citizenship?
So there's a couple ways in which immigration reforms would increase the tax, state and local taxes paid by currently undocumented Oregonians. The first is that folks who are gain legal status have to comply fully with the tax code. So anyone who wasn't paying on payroll tax, for instance, would have to do so. Another way in which revenues would increase is that folks with legal status tend to earn more money, and folks who are earning more money end up paying more of that money in state and local taxes.
Or how great would the boost be to local and state revenues if the undocumented Oregonians were given citizenship?
So in 2012, ITEP, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, in 2012, ITEP estimates that undocumented Oregonians paid $83 million in state and local taxes. They estimate that with comprehensive immigration reform, that would increase by 47%. So Oregon could expect to see an additional $39 million in state and local revenues. And last year, President Obama issued an executive action that would protect certain undocumented folks from deportation. And if those executive actions were allowed to be fully implemented, Oregon could expect to see an additional $18 million in state and local tax revenue.
I think it's an interesting argument overall. So I was wondering if you find this issue of taxes to be effective, an effective argument for supporting citizenship?
It's one argument of many of why we need comprehensive immigration reform in this country. Oregon is one of, I think, nearly a dozen states or so that have supported President Obama's executive actions on immigration. So I think, our representatives know that this is something that we need. And additional tax revenue is just one of the many reasons why immigration reform makes sense.
And I don't know if this was part of the study, but maybe some people have concerns that undocumented Oregonians may use more than their fair share of local and state resources. Did you study anything comparing them to other residents?
So that's not something that's included in the study. I think what the study makes clear is that undocumented Oregonians are already contributing heavily to the state and local resources that we all rely on. So whether it's our education system or roads and these public infrastructures that we all rely heavily on, it's very clear from this report that undocumented Oregonians are paying their fair share into the system. And I think it's important to note, too, that with legal status, they would be paying a higher share of their income in state and local taxes than do the 1% currently.
For KBOO News, I've been speaking with Tyler McInnes of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm Eric Tegedoff. A group of activists are currently holding a 24-hour vigil in front of the U.S. Capitol, calling on Congress to say no to fast-tracking a controversial trade agreement. The activists, who are part of the group Popular Resistance, say that the Trans-Pacific Partnership will potentially cost millions of U.S. jobs, will set up an economic trading bloc meant to isolate and intimidate China, and will have devastating impacts on the environment, workers, rights, civil liberties, consumer rights, and indigenous rights. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Kevin Zeiss from outside the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., where he is engaging in a 24-hour vigil to stop the fast-tracking of the TPP.
Kevin, could you tell us what the scene is outside of the U.S. Capitol and what you all are doing out there?
Well, we have an encampment set up that has a massive 30-foot sign that says Stop the TPP, corporate coup against people and planet. We have a few signs with lists of the Hall of Shame, those who voted wrongly on these issues. We have a list of those who voted to stop the TAA, which is the labor assistance, which has been a key plank of the Obama trade. And by stopping that, they've actually stopped us from moving forward. And we're in this stage now where they're looking to do a revote this week on the TAA, the Trade Assistance Authority.
It's a little bit confusing as far as this TPA and TAA and what happened last week. Could you maybe lay that out a little bit for listeners?
Sure. The Republicans made a decision to divide the Obama fast-track bill into two parts, the TAA and the TPA. The TAA, you're right, is labor assistance, and then TPA is essentially the fast-track. And that was, I think, an interesting choice they made. And as a result of that, there was a vote on TAA. The problem was the TAA was very problematic. It was not funded enough, not covering public workers, and it was being funded by a Medicare cut. So those are three big problems, in addition to the tactical issue of TAA was needed in order for the fast track to pass. And so for those reasons, people voted against it, and including 86 Republicans voting for it, which is really a surprise. They normally wouldn't get that kind of number. They voted for it for tactical reasons. The Senate has voted for this already, and they have a bill that combines TPA and TAA as one bill. And so the House has to match that. They have to have the same bill in order to become law. And so if the TAA is not included, the Senate would have to vote on the House version. And there's already been 8 senators who voted for it last time that said they would not vote for it without TAA. So I think there's a really good chance that we could stop it this time. And I think we're on the verge of a big victory.
It seems very odd that President Obama, who
presents himself as somewhat progressive, and our Oregon senators, who also claim to be progressive, voted in favor of Fast Track. Why is it that so many supposed progressives are getting behind something that is so obviously against workers and the environment?
Well, you know, President Obama really is a Wall Street Democrat. I mean, I think that he does have great rhetoric on sounding progressive, but he is a Wall Street Democrat. That's, they put the most money into his campaigns. They're the ones who really made his campaign viable. And he has been a Wall Street Democrat even before he ran for president. So I think that was a misimpression people had. His health care bill is basically an investor's bill. It's great for the insurance companies, for the for-profit hospitals, and for the pharmaceutical industry. So Wall Street loves that health care legislation. It's making them rich. It's not really great for consumers, as we're starting to see now. People are getting more expensive health care, higher premiums, higher out-of-pocket costs, and can't afford to go to get the health care they need. So it's not really working for consumers, but it works for Wall Street. So he's a Wall Street Democrat. In addition, we're going through this Asian pivot, which is this military maneuver of moving 65% of our Navy to the Asian Pacific to encircle China. The TPP does not include China. The other massive trade agreement, the Trade and Services Agreement, which is even bigger, includes 50 countries. Among those not included are China and Russia. And so these are economic weapons against adversaries around the world. And so that's another reason. And the final reason is because President Obama is about to retire. He has a long life ahead of him. He's trying to build 3 Obama centers, one in Chicago, one in New York, one in Hawaii. And so he wants to raise $500 million for that. $500 million does not come from $25 contributions. It comes from big business interests giving lots of money. And he'll be doing 6-figure speeches. He'll be doing books that get massive publication. And he'll be running creating a nonprofit. So he's following the Bill Clinton model. The Clintons have made tens of millions in the last few years. So that's where the future is for him. So I think he also has a personal interest in this. So I think those 3 reasons really are why we're seeing Obama support this. Other members I don't know well enough to give you answers on why they're doing it. I think it's complicated when you're a Pacific coast state, when you have ports that deal with Pacific trade. I think that's complicated, although the Seattle City Council unanimously voted against Fast Track, urging their representatives to vote against Fast Track. So I think that's the more sensible position, but people get confused sometimes and don't see the full bigger picture.
I know here in Oregon, people have been calling their representatives in opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. At least Earl Blumenauer's office and other representatives have reported receiving quite a large number of calls in opposition. Is that a national phenomenon as well? Are people really standing up against this fast-tracking of the TPP?
No question. There's been a populist rebellion across the political spectrum. Not only are Democrats receiving lots of calls from their base, but so are Republicans. The Tea Party is energized on this. The top 4 right-wing talk show hosts have come out against it. Of course, we're seeing on the left side, we're seeing the largest coalition ever to oppose trade agreements. We had one day a week and a half ago where we did a call-in day. In one day, we had 60,000 phone calls made by our coalition. I suspect last week, every day, there were tens of thousands of phone calls into Congress. And so it's a real classic fight of the people versus money, the populace versus the elites. And we really get a chance to see which side our representatives stand on. Do they listen to the people? Did Blumenauer listen to those massive numbers of phone calls from his constituents? Or did he vote with the corporations? He voted with the corporations. And I hope the people of Oregon remember that and find someone to replace them.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us. I'm speaking with Kevin Zeese. Kevin is with Popular Resistance. You can find out more about this rebellion against a rigged trade agreement, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements that are potentially being fast-tracked, which will allow the president to negotiate these trade agreements without the approval of Congress in violation of the Constitution. Kevin Zeese, PopularResistance.org. Thank you so much for joining us on KBOO.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, June 15th, 2015. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian and kidnap others during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man was shot and killed, then crushed by Israeli soldiers on Sunday at dawn during an invasion targeting the village of Kfar Malik near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Witnesses said that Abdullah Iyad Ghanayim, 22 years of age, was on his way to work when Israeli troops shot him, then crushed their jeep on top of him, killing him. The Israeli army forced local medics and residents away from helping Ghanayim until he died under the military jeep. Residents clashed with the invading troops, who fired live rounds and tear gas. As a result, 12 residents were injured and dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. Later, Israeli soldiers kidnapped late on Sunday at night and early on Monday 12 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including occupied Jerusalem, seized scores of homes and installed roadblocks near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers invaded Palestinian olive orchards in Hussein town near the West Bank city of Bethlehem and uprooted dozens of olive saplings. According to the villagers, the soldiers invaded 20 dunams, 4.9 acres of orchards, that were planted more than 3 years ago and uprooted the saplings. The soldiers also took the uprooted saplings with them, then left the area. Moreover, the soldiers informed the local council that the Palestinian-owned orchards are considered a state land and that the Palestinians are not allowed to plant or even enter them. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 15th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Sarah Swetsoff, and Ken Jones. The producer is Eric Tegedoff. Our engineer is Mike Vitoklis. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about an issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor hosts the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, author and activist David Corton speaks on a new story. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints. Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D-May Roberts speaks with award-winning modern Indian music singer Kiran Ahluwalia about her latest album, Sonata Stillness. And at 11:30 a.m. on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, about David Hockney's 16 etchings called A Rake's Progress. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can be one. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to start the process.
And now stay tuned for an interview with one of the organizers of last week's peace rally for Yemen. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Eric. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland was one of hundreds of cities around the world that hosted a peace rally for Yemen this past Saturday, June 13th. The International Day of Action was called in response to Yemeni civilians' demands for immediate ceasefire and lifting of the Saudi blockade. The blockade is intended to prevent the rebels from provisioning, but meanwhile, it has cut off Yemeni civilians from essential food and fuel imports. In addition, Saudi airstrikes and local ground fighting have taken more than 2,000 Yemeni lives. KBOO's Sarah Swetsoff spoke with one of the organizers of last week's rally.
I'm here with Maha Al-Yusufi, a graduate student in the Conflict Resolution Program at Portland State University. This past weekend, Maha was the press contact for a rally for peace in Yemen, where a small, passionate group of Portland residents came together to ask for a ceasefire and an immediate lifting of the blockade on Yemen. Maha, I was wondering if you could start out by giving some more information about yourself and